The recipe for success in a Douglas County school board is all 7 school board members to work together.
I think I'm the right guy for the job because this board really needs leadership.
You can't be intimidated by numbers and financials, and I'm definitely not. I have 10 plus years experience working in accounting.
Right now, Douglas County is not even close in comparison with neighboring districts paying our teachers, and we need to do a better job.
My name is Becky Myers.
I'm Mike Peterson.
I'm Kaylee Weininger.
I'm Christy Williams.
And I approve this message.
Thanks for listening to The Fan Late Night on demand. I'm Sean Drotar, and before I start using a bunch of unnecessarily long-winded words to describe what's latest and greatest in Denver sports, make sure you follow the rest of the station's podcasts. Subscribe wherever you download your podcasts, and always at 1043thefan.com.
They have not generally been competitive. But yes, I think certainly for our purposes here, this game will be about what Denver does or doesn't do in trying to break something that even under Vic Fangio, they have never had, a 5-game losing streak.
Five games is an awful situation. They don't happen that often in the NFL to any teams, except, well, the Lions. Happens to the Lions a lot for various reasons. But most normal NFL teams do not go through 5-game losing streaks. Even the ones that are bad generally don't lose 5 in a row. That's the kind of thing that separates the underachievers from the hopeless to a certain extent. And it's obviously something the Broncos want to avoid. In this particular case, how important is it for this team to get out in front early? We know this offense does not play well from behind. We've seen it. But get up front early. They want to pass on the earlier downs more often. You can argue with that strategy a bit. I most certainly would. But that's what they want to do. And now with Jerry Jeudy back, they should have an opportunity to be a little more dynamic in that area. But, Sandy, I'm of the belief now with this Broncos team that if they're down 10 points at any point during the game, it's not absolutely a loss, but it's probably a loss. And if they're down 2 touchdowns, they're probably out of it. They have to start fast.
We'll give you what amounts to the efficiency metric that Football Outsiders has developed over the years, known as DVOA. And for the Broncos on offense, they rank surprisingly high and on defense surprisingly low, 14th and 26th. Washington is 23rd and 28th. The difference comes on special teams. Now, generally, not always, but generally, special teams advantages or disadvantages develop over the course of the game. A game that's decided on a special teams play in the first 5 minutes of the contest is very rare. Remember that in the first 5 minutes of the first quarter and the first 5 minutes of the third quarter, the Broncos, in their 2012 divisional playoff game here against the Baltimore Ravens, had 2 big special teams plays at the beginning of each half. One was literally the first play of a half, a kickoff return for a touchdown. The other was a punt return for a touchdown. Somehow, the Broncos managed to lose that game in spite of getting 2 major special teams plays made against a team that basically for the last decade has been a top 10 special teams outfit. Usually, those plays on special teams don't decide games early on. So I go to the next strongest group involved when these two teams go up against each other, and that's the Denver offense. The Denver offense has the burden, perhaps more so now than we ever could have imagined, of giving the defense a break, giving the defense a chance to defend with an advantage, because we know how bad this defense has been when the Broncos have fallen behind. We know early in games how bad this defense has been, how late in games how bad this defense has been. So the Broncos whether they have the chance to possess the ball first or not, I think in this game, more critically than any other factor, have to be the first team on the scoreboard, even if it's just a field goal. They did not have any field goal attempts at Cleveland in their last game.
Right.
Zero.
In Denver, of course, there's no excuse because the distance there is extended based on where you can kick from, realistically, especially with Brandon McManus. You basically have NFL record distance available if you need it. So I'm with you on this one, and I don't necessarily care how they get there, but this team has to find a way to move the ball down into the red zone. And when they do, they need to cash it in. I'm not going to be under any illusion that this team's all of a sudden going to become an 80% conversion rate in the red zone or anything like that when you're talking about touchdowns. They're not. But you have to get there and you have to put up points. The one thing the Broncos have not done very well that stands out, at least, among this kind of discussion, is they haven't put together back-to-back scoring drives of any type with any frequency, even back-to-back field goals. This team doesn't string them together, and that's a major problem because it keeps you from building any momentum in the game, and it constantly lets the opposition in.
Outside of the first three games, have you sensed, even when the Broncos have been close, and sometimes they have been late in games over the past month, last week was an example of that. 17-14 with a little more than 5 minutes to go. You've just scored a touchdown. You feel almost certain you'll get the ball back. You might not have a lot of time. You might not have any timeouts. You might not even have the two-minute warning with which to stop the clock when you do. But you're going to get the ball back, aren't you?
One would think. I mean, knowing everyone in the building knows they're going to run. And right.
In fact, Cleveland had to make a conscious effort not to score.
Right.
Certainly not kick a field goal, because what's the point of that? A touchdown still beats you at 20-14. So they had no intention of doing anything but falling down. If the Broncos allowed them to score even a touchdown, they were going to fall down. The Broncos were out of timeouts. It was past the 2 minute warning. They were just going to let the clock run out. So I'll reemphasize this because I wasn't planning on making this a chief point, but it really is, and I'm reminded of something I read in a different context. It had to do with fantasy players you might want to select this week. ESPN runs a weekly piece that in part is focused on, among all fantasy available players, who's the guy you'd want to take? And Jeremy Fowler and his colleague at ESPN, Dan Graziano, write a weekly column where they call for certain upsets to take place, fantasy football sleepers and flops, trade buzz, notes around the league. And I see them getting to Jerry Jeudy here when it comes to fringe fantasy players you might take this week.
I can absolutely see that because I think he's going to get the targets immediately. I think Teddy Bridgewater needs to feed him.
And here's what else I see, and we'll get to the good doctor, Rick Perea, to talk about things that happen from the neck on up that might have an impact on this game in just a second. But I want to make the point. Here's Graziano as they go back and forth in this in-print dialogue. Love Jeudy. Love this Bronco offense. Now, I want those words framed and bronzed. Now, I'm taking it out of context. He doesn't generally love the Bronco offense, but here's what he says in its entirety. Love this Broncos offense against the Washington defense, parenthetically, though Washington did play a bit better against the Packers in week 7. I was thinking about taking Jeudy's quarterback here. That would be the banged up, injured, and somewhat ineffective in recent weeks, Teddy Bridgewater. That's in print on ESPN.com. I read it today. I got out my magnifying glass to make sure I was reading that statement correctly in any context.
I need to get in a league with those guys.
Bronco offense. Get in a fantasy league.
Seriously.
No, I understand Jeudy, because you don't think Bridgewater will target Jeudy 7 or 8 times?
Yes, absolutely. Well,
we talked about that last night.
Yes.
So, anyway, I thought I'd just make mention of that at the beginning of the program today. Somebody out there, there aren't many, somebody out there, at least for this week, loves the Denver Bronco offense.
Well, they're going to need it in order to break this four-game losing streak. And joining us now, someone very familiar to your programs over the years, a man who was working with the Broncos in their championship season as a performance psychologist, Dr. Rick Perea. And welcome to the show, Doc. And I guess the first thing I want to ask is you've worked with a lot of athletes and teams. When you have had a situation where you have such a great start, and maybe you're believing in yourself, and then it all falls apart, like what we see with the Broncos, with the high of winning their opening three, and then losing four in a row and coming back to earth, how do you find a way to center yourself somewhere in the middle?
That's a great question. Hey, guys, how are you doing this evening? Hope everybody's feeling good. I'm feeling serendipitous. So let's do this. So here's my thing, Sean, that I would – you know, really try to depict and delineate what's going on specifically with the Broncos. Somewhere along the line, it was, I think, after the first game, could have been after game two when Denver was 2-0.
Yeah.
But there were a couple of coaches, and one specifically, the head coach, mm-hmm. who made a statement, and he said, you know, if we can get back to Denver at 3-0, those fans are going to be so fired up and they're going to love us. Something
right.
to that effect.
Right. Oh, I remember.
Right?
Yes.
Okay.
Yep.
Now, in effect, what he did is he gave his own team a certain level of psychological expectation, meaning that, you know what, if we can get through these road games at 3-0, in essence, he was saying, we kind of got this thing made. We kind of got this thing in a good position.
Right.
And you know, I'll tell you guys, it doesn't always have to be an explicit message. It can be implicit and be really interpreted by the brain. And that's what psychology, you know, that's what we do, is we study how the brain interprets information and messages. So you don't have to say to players, hey, we get to 3-0, lay down, we got it made. That would be explicit. But implicitly, when you say, if we can make it back to Denver at 3-0, the fans are going to be excited. But in effect, I think he was also saying, hey, if we get back there at 3-0, we're in a pretty good spot. Well, you guys know as well as anybody, in the NFL, hey, you know what? Whether you're home or away, anything can happen. Turnovers, injuries, you never know. And I can tell you this, you know, the team that turns the ball over most loses about 92% of the time. So turnovers just plays a huge role in the momentum of the game.
Sure.
So I happen to think, of course, he didn't do that intentionally. No coach would. But that's where I think we need to understand in our profession how important word choice is when we get in front of our players, how important word choice is when we're in meetings with other coaches. Guys, I've been in meetings before where coaches say things that just make me cringe because I know the word choice they're using is not the best choice to motivate athletes. And so that's the way I'd answer that, Sean, is that nobody purposely handicaps their teams, but inadvertently, because of their ignorance. Now, what's the root word of ignorance? It's ignore.
Yeah.
Because they ignore critical information about how they're communicating with their team. And that's my only gripe about the NFL in terms of the psychological aspect. We got to have more coaches that understand the psychology of motivation and the psychology of winning.
You're exactly right, and he did make that statement, Vic Fangio did, after the Jacksonville game. They were 2-0 coming home. Now, they could have played the Jets on Mars and shut them out the way they did. Our promotional statement, which you may or may not have been aware of, was that the real home opener, right, Sean, was it opening day 2.0,
right,
didn't come on September 26th with the New York Jets. The real home opener was October 3rd against the Baltimore Ravens. Now, we're a radio station. We promote to create interest and also capture the reality of a 3-0 team going 3-0 against three of the worst teams in the NFL at that point, probably three of the worst four or five, if not exactly the three worst teams in the league. We were acknowledging all that. But for a coach, basically, as you suggest, to put words to that idea, oh, yes, we're 3-0, and sure, the Ravens are coming in, but, you know, we're going to have the crowd behind us. We've got it licked. It seemed that he was taking winning for granted in a way that we all know you can never do in sports. And he was also getting ahead of himself, which was funny for a coach who had started his first 2 years here, Rick, 0-4 and 0-3, to get so right. carried away, because he certainly never said the season's over in 19 after they started 0-4, or in 2020 when they started 0-3. But he sort of lent credence to the idea that the Broncos were sitting in hog heaven at 3-0.
Yeah. Well, you know, one of the things, I'm definitely not going to be Vic's favorite guy if he hears any of this, but that's okay. That's the beauty in what I do now, Sandy, because I'm not attached to any team per
right.
se. I work with multiple executives at different teams. And just so the listeners understand, I work from everybody from the GMs to EVPs to director of player personnel, all the way down to coaches and players and so really at everyone in the building. But I can tell you this, now that I'm more in a freelance role, I can speak freely and clearly about this. You know, I don't know exactly how old Vic was when he got this head job. I want to say 60.
Yeah.
Okay, so to my recollection, he'd never been a head coach before.
That's right. Yes.
Okay, well, there's a reason why. Okay, I say this because I've been around coaches. I was a coach at one time, not at the NFL level, but I've been a coach, I've been a psychologist, I've been a player. And I can tell you what, the guys that really, you know, the Nick Sabans of the world, the Bill Belichicks of the world, they elevate from position coach to coordinator, from coordinator to head guy
right.
for a reason and for many reasons. And one of the reasons they do is because they have really good communication skills. They have really good skills at connecting with players, at leadership skills, those type of things. I'm always a little leery when someone gets the first head job in their late 50s, mid-50s, early 60s. Now, the guy at Tampa Bay, we can make an argument and say, okay, he did that. But I think at the same time, there's a combination of player cohesion on that team that's really taken him to another level. But I do think that there's reasons why coaches get promoted and why they don't get promoted. I'm not saying he's a poor head coach. That's not for me to really judge. But I would say as a defensive coordinator, I think he was more effective. You know, Sandy, you and I both know someone out there in the world by the name of Adam Gase, and he's very dear to me. He's a friend. His family is a friend of mine as well.
Yes.
But I can tell you what, I mean, you know, he's probably at this point in his career a better coordinator, maybe even position coach of quarterbacks, than he is as a head coach. And that's just being really honest. And you know, he's the one that hired me down in Miami. So I'm indebted to him forever. But I tell you what, his skill set right now matches better as a coordinator. So I think we have to be honest with ourselves as people who assess these guys, these coaches, that, you know, the skills and the acumen that work for him as a position coach or as a coordinator do not always transfer to the head guy. And we have seen that time and time again where successful coordinators, a la Josh McDaniel, as an example, don't necessarily transfer into
right.
that skill set that's required as a head
right.
coach. So,
great example.
I think we need to be very aware of that.
Doctor, the comment by Teddy Bridgewater today I thought was very interesting when he was asked, you know, is it time to panic? And he said, quote, "It's not time to panic, but it almost is." Now that's gotten some interesting feedback as people look at it, and you know, the whole idea is, well, you're invincible, you never panic, you're calm, cool, and collected. I saw that as kind of a statement of leadership, holding not only himself but his teammates to the fire a little bit and saying, yeah, you know what, we're not playing in a way that is sustainable, and we probably need to be pretty close to panicked in order to turn this around. How do you interpret statements like that?
Yeah, I interpret that statement, Sean, as, again, an example of not completely understanding how important word choice is in leadership. In a leadership position, when you're the head coach of an NFL team, you are in effect a CEO. And so every word, and you're in these pressers in front of people, and these pressers are not just going to be conveyed to people in your organization. They're league wide. They're, you know, worldwide in effect with our social media the way it is. And when you say it's not time to panic, but it almost is, first of all, you never panic. Successful teams never panic. You know, here, going back to word choice, here's another example. And, you know, Sandy, you know me. I love John. John Elway, I think, he can do wrong. I don't want to pretend like I put him on that big of a pedestal. But I've been in a room with him before where I've just been very impressed with his thoughtfulness and his mindfulness. But he said something one time that a lot of coaches say, and it's absolutely wrong. He says, we need to play like we have our hair on fire.
Yeah.
That's absolutely wrong. You'd never want to play with your hair on fire. What you want to do is you want to play with intensity and purpose, but you never want to be on what's called that sympathetic side of the autonomic nervous system, is where stress and anxiety occur. Heart rate's up, respiration's up, muscle tension, and narrowing of thinking. The parasympathetic side of that system is where everything's calm. Heart rate's regulated, heart rate's down. No muscle tension and clarity of thinking. That's the where you want to play. And it doesn't matter whether you're an outside linebacker or a quarterback. You want to play in that zone is what we call it, or in the flow. And if you don't, you're going to be tense. You're going to make decisions that aren't equitable. I'll give you an example. If you look at Tom Brady and Peyton Manning, from the neck up, those are two of the best that have ever played. From the neck down, they're very average. I mean, let's look at arm strength. Let's look at velocity.
Right.
They're very average. You know, Peyton really couldn't even run. He ran like a duck. Let's be honest, right? Compare them to Cam Newton. Cam Newton from the neck down is a freak. I've seen him do things in pregame warm-up that a man that big shouldn't be able to do. He's extremely athletic. He's very, you know, he's got a very strong arm. But from the neck up, he's an adolescent. So he'll never go down in history as a great, great quarterback because he doesn't have the neck up. Now, if you put Tom and Peyton's neck up on Cam's body, you'd have Robo QB. I mean, they'd be a freak. So we really got to understand how important word choice is, and it sets us up on that sympathetic and parasympathetic of the autonomic nervous system, because I'm telling you right now, Sean, and Sandy's heard me say this several times, when you're on that parasympathetic side, that's when you're going to be the most effective. When Peyton used to stand in shotgun and he looks at a cover two and he understands they're disguising it as a three and they're going to jump to man underneath and zone over the top, he can do that because he's on the calm side of his nervous system. When a climb, and that's when he's predictable and that's when he's ineffective. So word choice really sets up how calm we are, or how anxious we are. And this goes all the way back to what Vic's statement was, it's not time to panic, it almost is. A great leader never panics, a great team never panics. So I would have changed his word choice, definitely, in being the leader of the Denver Broncos.
Right. Very quickly before I let you go, I know you work with Tyler Matzik. We talked about him at length last night when you were around the Rockies some 5 years ago. And I just wanted to give you a minute to talk about how happy you must be for the success he is now enjoying as a critical World Series participant for the Atlanta Braves. In fact, among the people most responsible for getting them into the World Series went against the Dodgers the other night, one of the great lineups of this century so far in Major League Baseball. He struck out Albert Pujols, a certain future Hall of Famer, and Mookie Betts, a former MVP and a possible future Hall of Famer, with runners on second, third, and nobody out in the seventh inning of the climactic game of that series, turned out to be Game 6. And how he's turned not only his career, but his life around in the last 5 years.
Yeah, I can't say enough about Ty. Ty's just one of those kids that you know, when he came in and did work with us, he put his nose to the grindstone. He did it. You know, he asked me, he says, Doc, what do I got to do? And I gave him five things he needed to do, and he met all five of them. You know, it's so important to understand how important your ecosystems are around you. You know, we call them your micro ecosystem is the people that you see really on a daily basis. Your macro is the people you see occasionally, once a week, once every 2 weeks. For athletes, their micro ecosystem is vital. People have to believe in you. Executives have to believe in you. You know, when I was in Miami, Sandy, you came down there a couple of times. You were close to the situation. Ryan Tannehill blew out his knee two years in a row.
Yeah.
And
sure.
You know what? Our EVP gave up on it.
Yep.
He says, no, he's done. He's
sure.
done. And I remember sitting in those meetings and saying, no, he's not. This kid's got more. He's got more gas in the tank because he's so positive. He does all my work. And I get it, you know, so they pretty much gave up on him. So when he became the 2019 comeback player of the year, I knew he had it in him all along. And there was one point when even his wife wanted him to retire. So in one time, you know, RT, Ryan Tannehill, told me, he says, Doc, you're the only one that believes in me. And I says, bro, that'll change. Just keep working. So going back to Tyler, there was a time when I think the only people that believed in him were me and his at that time, fiance and him.
Right.
It was it. But yeah. I knew he could get there, and I'm so happy for him because he's an example for so many people out there who at times don't think you're ever going to make it back. You're frustrated. You can't seem to get everything right, and look where he's at. When you just stick with things, you have a great ecosystem around you, you build, and you keep believing every day, positive. Anything's possible, Sandy, and you know that firsthand.
Yeah, and very quickly for readers who want to read more about the Tyler Matzik story, terrific piece by Patrick Saunders in the Denver Post. I believe it was yesterday. I lose track of the days sometimes. But today in the New York Times, an equally fine piece on Tyler Matzik entitled Tyler Matzik's Journey from the Air Hogs to the World Series. It is compelling reading. It will send a shiver up your spine as you read of Tyler Matzik, who, by the way, Sean Drotar, started the home opener for the Colorado Rockies in 2015.
Right.
And was excised from the organization over the objections of our guest tonight less than a year later after being their home opening day starter.
He is Dr. Rick Prehm. Make sure you can check him out on his performance psychology on his website, thinkoneforyou.org. Make sure you check that out for all the insights there. Thanks for the time tonight, Doc. Appreciate talking to you.
Sean, Sandy, a pleasure as usual. Love you guys. Keep believing. Keep being positive. For all the listeners out there, every day is a new day, a new opportunity for success. Thanks, guys.
Thanks so much. He joins us on the Johnson Auto Plaza hotline. A lot of insight there. And thinking about being positive, Sandy.
Yes.
Injury news for the Denver Broncos keeps trending in the right direction for a change. We'll talk about it next.
It's Sandy and Sean on Denver's Sports Station, 104.3 The Fan.
Good. Thought he had a good practice. You know, ran around good, looked good running his routes. You know, I was pleased with the way he looked.
That is Vic Fangio, of course, talking about Jerry Jeudy. And not only are things trending in the right direction for him to be back, he's back. And you know, you can tell he's not even listed on the Broncos injury report. Now, of course, he should be ready to go on Sunday. And I expect, like you said in the last segment, talking about how folks at ESPN loved the idea of Jeudy coming back in the first game so much that they recommended picking Teddy Bridgewater and Jerry Jeudy for your fantasy team. Not going to go
well.
Quite.
Yeah, they're a little stronger on Jeudy.
Far.
But yes, they suggested, yeah, you might even think about taking Bridgewater. And the two have an unmistakable rapport.
They do.
Absolutely the case. And apparently there's more good news, not at the wide receiver position necessarily, but at a position very closely related to it in terms of available targets that Teddy Bridgewater might have at his disposal. And he hasn't had these people, of course, in recent weeks.
Yes, indeed. This is Vic Fangio on Alberto Cuevanon.
Yeah, he did good, too. You know, he didn't talk to him a couple times during the practice, didn't seem to have any effects, didn't come in today with after effects. So, you know, arrow up there.
Arrow up.
Arrow up. Better than arrow down Or no arrow. Arrow up is the best arrow.
I guess that's general. Where Vaughn Miller is, arrow sideways. But, yes, arrow up for Albert O and obviously for Jerry Jeudy as well. And two big targets who were looked at frequently earlier this year.
And speed.
By Teddy Bridgewater.
Speed that was missing in the last few weeks, and it has been noticeable. It felt as if the Broncos offense continues to get kind of stuck in the mud. That's been part of it. Now, speed is not everything. Don't get me wrong. You can certainly beat teams if you're not a speedy team. You have to have certain different sets of skills than the Broncos do at the moment to do that. But that speed will help, obviously. Anytime those guys can get open faster, and it's not necessarily the deep ball, Sandy, that I look at when you talk about some of the speed, like a guy like Jeudy or a guy like Okwuegbunam. Yes, they can get down the field, but for a Broncos team that has had difficulty containing the pass rush, their speed gives them potentially something that they haven't been able to have with Cortland Sutton and Tim Patrick, both guys who have done a fine job, by the way, as really the only two targets of significance. But when you're fast, like Jerry Jeudy, you can also get open faster on a short route, on a slant, whatever it is. That will help Bridgewater be able to get the ball out faster, and hopefully that will derail some of the pass rush that has been coming hot and heavy after him in the past few weeks.
Now, we obviously take note of this, taking no joy in it, because I love watching this wide receiver play. But Terry McLaurin of the Washington football team did not practice today.
He did not.
It was a bit of a hamstring injury. And this is generally a day in which offensive installment takes place. And for McLaurin not to practice today, I'm guessing would make him maybe questionable for Sunday.
That would be the likeliest guess when they get to that. And obviously for the Broncos, like you said, you're certainly not rooting for anything like that. And the truth is, if you're a football fan, you'd like to see Terry McLaurin on the field.
Sure.
Because
I like to watch him play.
Entertaining. But yes, it may very well be that he's questionable. I think that would be the best way that you would call it. The actual concern, according to John Kind of ESPN, was listed as an ankle earlier Wednesday. Now it's been corrected to the hamstring.
Right.
But this has been impacting practice time for the last couple of weeks. So this may be maintenance related, but
Could be.
John Kime, who reports on that team for ESPN, suggested that it may be more than that. And we'll have to find out basically more on Thursday. Well, the other person that we may find out more on Thursday that doesn't have a designation, but would probably be listed as, well, the same, is Vaughn Miller.
I think it's, honestly, if today was, if we had the list category, he'd be questionable.
I don't think that's a surprise. That's not a surprise, I wouldn't think, after the ankle injury that he suffered. It looked like it was much more serious than maybe even the knee at the time.
Could have been season-threatening.
Very, very good if you're going to get hit there to not be planted at the time. And that, fortunately, Miller was actually airborne when that collision happened and gave his leg a little bit of room to move. Now, they've added a couple of guys we'll get to Kenny Young in a minute because that is entertainment. I will just hint it. Kenny Young may not be as thrilled to be here as some other players have been. Let's put it that way. But the addition of Stephen Weatherly, who's been an edge rusher, a bit of an outside, either outside on the line with a hand down or an outside linebacker. He was excited to be here when he was introduced to media yesterday. I think he understands that as a guy that's been in the league for 6 years, this really is a good chance, and it's not the way you necessarily want to get it, but the reality is this is a good chance to get some snaps and an opportunity to show what you can do. And he's here, admittedly, because he played under George Payton in Minnesota. He's gone to the well there now for four different players. Teddy Bridgewater, Mike Boone, Shamar Stephan, and now Weatherly. Is that the right idea to go with that many guys from the team you just left, especially when the team you just left isn't, say, the Tampa Bay Buccaneers?
He has been equally, as far as I can tell, praised and criticized for these moves. Praised for taking advantage of a player personnel group that he knows rather well, dipping into that pool of knowledge about these players. about whom he may have more insight. And Stefan, for example, has been, I think, better than expected.
Yes.
Would that be a fair assessment in recent weeks?
Absolutely.
I think he's been better than Deshaun Williams, and he's been better than Mike Purcell. Again, during a four-game stretch where obviously no one has been outstanding, but I'm talking about a couple of reserve players, Stefan being one of them, who it seems to me have qualitatively outperformed Purcell and Williams, who are the other two people who play primarily on the nose. The Broncos aren't always in 3-4, of course. That's their base defense. So sometimes they're in what amounts to 4-3. Your base defense isn't even the defense
the base,
you play a majority of the time.
The base defense in the NFL is the nickel.
Anymore.
Nickel is base.
Nickel's your base defense.
Everybody's base.
And, you know, your coverage schemes may vary, but most teams spend most of the time defensively with five defensive backs on the field. And so I understand going to an area in which you have knowledge based on years of experience with an organization, but I also understand the idea that he is taking two players who might otherwise be equal. Maybe even one has the slight edge over the other. And even if that's true, he's going to pick the Viking. And the natural question that comes out of that, tell me again exactly what the Vikings have accomplished over the last 15 years. They've been to one conference championship game, and that was in kind of a magical, perhaps somewhat flukish 2017 season, which benefited George Payton, certainly benefited Pat Shurmur, then the offensive coordinator of the Vikings, and perhaps works to the advantage of some of these players he's looking at now, whether they were on that team or came on a little bit later on. And, you know, that's kind of low-hanging fruit, taking guys like this. And then when he goes outside the organization, we find, as you indicated, that the player he traded for the other day, for some reason, didn't want to leave one of the top two or three teams in the NFL and join one of the 10 to 12 worst teams in the NFL at the present time.
Well, despite Kenny Young's, sort of natural disappointment, I would think, given that situation, the Broncos have an enormously important game in front of them on Sunday. Three games left before the bye, Sandy. If they win, they'd be 4-4. They actually get their way to the bye being .500 or better. We'll talk about that next.
You're listening to Sandy and Sean on Denver's Sports Station, 104.3 The Fan.
The Denver Broncos have, I guess, we can't call it do or die, Sandy, I suppose, because, look, it's week 8. There are 9 more. We're not even at the halfway point. But is it fair to say that if they lose this game, their narrow playoff chances go completely up
Yeah, and they're narrow to non-existent now. I think the framework around this game is more along the lines of reestablishing at least some semblance of credibility somewhere. We talked about the offense in the first segment, and strange as this may seem to some, they have been no worse, arguably better, over the last month on offense than they've been on defense in the last month. I would dare say in the first month they were much better on offense than they've been in the last four games. But you had to give the nod to the defense, right? In terms of scoring offense through the first 3 weeks, they were averaging a fair number of points. They were upper half of the league. But the defense was giving up fewer points than anybody the first 3 weeks. Now, a lot of that had to do with the fact that they were playing the Giants, the Jaguars, and the Jets in the first 3 weeks, as we have since found out. But in the last month, the defense against Baltimore, okay, that's a bad day. A great quarterback came in, had a big day throwing the ball, unusually productive in the passing game, according to the patterns established previously by Lamar Jackson. But then they go to Pittsburgh against a broken offense, and they get lit up. And they go up against Las Vegas, which lost its offensive-minded head coach
that
under
week.
Sudden circumstances that very week, and had scored the day before that coach was fired all of 9 points in a home game against one of the weaker teams in the league, although a pretty good defensive team, the Chicago Bears. That was the Las Vegas Raiders, and the Raiders lit the Broncos up. And then they go to Cleveland. The Browns are playing their third-string running back as a starter. They are playing a basically career backup, with the exception of the 1 year he spent with the Vikings in 17, and really one full season. And that's the only season in his career where from start to finish he was the acknowledged starting quarterback. And that was the following year for the Broncos here in Denver. We're talking about Case Keenum, of course, and a team that, had an unproductive and perhaps not fully healthy Odell Beckham and Jarvis Landry, who was very good in the game but was banged up a little bit even during the course of that game. So they weren't exactly loaded on the outside.
Nobody had more than 42 receiving yards.
And they weren't burned by any one guy in the passing game. It was just certain plays at the beginning and end of the game that defensively exposed the Broncos in that game. And now Washington comes to town, and they come to town with an offense that doesn't seem very functional either. But we've said that in the last three games, if not the last four games, about each opponent. So I'm a little suspicious in this case, and I'm not sure that I'm prepared to pick Denver in this game. The Broncos are a standard 3-point favorite at home, no more than that, against an atrocious team, especially on the road. The Washington football team has not fared well in the last couple of seasons. They have their own quarterback issues, and I would probably take, if I were to pick between the two, I would take Teddy Bridgewater over Heinicke right now.
I would. I think that's right.
But it is, I think, from an offensive point of view, forget about the defense this week and just look at the Broncos on offense and say they have to reestablish some degree of credibility, because they have become, now through seven games, one of the 10 worst offensive teams in the NFL. I think over the last month they've been one of the 10 worst defensive teams as well. And maybe for the year, you take the last four games more seriously than you did the first three. But to me, this is, if you're going to call it a must game, must win for a team that's basically got, what, a 13% chance to make the playoffs,
roughly, yeah,
a 1-in-20 chance to win a division that a month
not
ago,
even worry about that.
A month ago, they seemed like a pretty good bet to contend for first and certainly for second place in the division. Now they're in last place, including tiebreakers. And you know what? We'll take the big picture look before we break at Pat Shurmur. 23 games now as offensive coordinator of the Denver Broncos. 16 last year, 7 this year so far. 29th in offensive expected points added. You know who the Broncos are ahead of?
Just Washington.
In the Pat Shurmur era.
Washington.
At 29. Washington is right behind
Detroit.
Them.
Has to be.
Nope.
Wow.
Way ahead. Detroit's way ahead of them.
Oh, my.
The two New Jersey teams.
Uh-huh.
The Giants and the Jets. So you've got Washington and the two Jersey teams, the Giants and the Jets.
This is over how many years? The last
who
three?
Have been, this is, no, this is the 23-game Pat Shurmur era as offensive coordinator, play caller of the Denver Broncos, 29th. It seems to me that against this particular opponent, you've got on the other side, an offensive team that over those same 23 games has been even worse than yours. You weren't better than Cleveland on offense. You weren't better than Las Vegas on offense. You weren't better than Pittsburgh on offense. You weren't better than Baltimore on offense. Two of the teams you played earlier, the Giants and the Jets, well, even Pat Shurmur couldn't be worse than the offenses from 2020 and so far in 2021. And now he gets the third team that's beneath the Broncos. After this game, they will be playing offensive teams that are demonstrably superior, vastly superior, and with the exception of maybe Detroit and Philadelphia, the Broncos will be expected to lose every single game they play after Sunday. They will be favored twice more after Sunday against Philadelphia and against Detroit in December, both games at home. They will not be favored to win any other games in 2021.
Well, maybe the third time is a charm on Sunday. Yeah. Of course, maybe it's also three strikes and you're out for the Broncos season. So there's a lot on the line. And the running game is going to have a lot to do with it. The pair of Vic Fangio and Pat Shurmur disagree with me on how they should be used. But they definitely need to be part of this offensive game plan if the Broncos are going to win. We heard from Vic Fangio a little earlier today about that running back rotation. We'll play it for you next.
Miss any of the Fan Late Night with Sean Drotar? Make sure to subscribe to our on-demand podcast. You'll get every episode as soon as they're released. Just subscribe wherever you get your podcasts or at 1043thefan.com.